Good morning and welcome to Storylines on the Bay 88.7 FM. I'm your host, Christine Cowley. Today we're speaking with author Michael Merola about his latest collection of short stories, The Photographer in Search of Death. Welcome to Storylines, Michael.
Thank you, Christine. Thank you for having me on the show.
My pleasure. Michael, you are also a publisher with Guernica Edition, so we will be talking about that in the second half of the show. But let's get right into your latest offering, The Photographer in Search of Death. Now, Michael, you're a novelist, you're a playwright, you've written film scripts and other short story and poetry collections. Tell us about this latest offering, The Photographer in Search of Death.
Okay, well, it's a collection of what I call, I would call speculative fiction, of ideas.
Uh-huh.
What I try to do in it, these are mostly short stories that have been published previously in journals and magazines. But what I try to do in the stories is take, what would normally be a regular situation or kind of a natural situation or a natural place, a place in a, like a room or that sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
And then take that and explode it. Let it run. Let it go into the worlds where things aren't natural. Things aren't, they become magical.
Yes.
In other words, it's difficult to describe them as a whole, the entire collection.
Well, they are different. I know with the first three, I've got to say, they kind of put me into this dream state, Michael. While I was reading them, I kind of felt like it was like being in my own dreams where things can just happen unexpectedly and people appear and disappear and do weird things. And it felt very much like I was entering into this other realm.
Yes, yeah, that's part of it. At the same time, I tried to keep them real, as it were, in the sense of, in some way or other, to have them grounded.
Uh-huh.
In the human experience. So they're basically, I would say, existential in the way they move forward. But yeah, there is a dreamlike quality to a lot of them, and in fact, some of them did come from dreams.
And, you know, existential is probably a great word to jump off on, because you have been compared to Beckett. You have been compared to other writers in the sort of absurdist alienation genre, if that's a genre. And actually, one of your critics, or the Calgary Herald, described your work as somewhere between Kafka and Vonnegut. Now, do you find that that's an accurate representation of your work?
I think so. I think that Kafka, at least, is one of my influences. One of my very
yeah.
early influences, and a writer that I really believe was, you know, captured that first half of the 20th century and the way the world moved forward in that period. So yeah, Kafka is one of the Vonnegut. I really love. I love his work, but I don't see him as much as an influence as Kafka. And then my other authors that I really I consider, you know, the backbone would be Joyce.
Uh-huh.
And
yes.
Beckett. And
and you can see that. I mean, certainly in those the first three, and I didn't find so much in as I carried on through, but I could certainly see that in the beginning of the collection.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I agree with that assessment.
I
take it a little beyond. I try to take it a little beyond Kafka and Beckett.
Yeah.
Beckett. I think Beckett kind of went the other way. He almost took human experience and boiled it down to like the bare essentials.
Mm.
You know, as he did in especially in Waiting for Godot.
Right, right.
But all his plays are like that. They're like he takes a complexity and he kind of shrinks it, kind of boils it down to the essentials, and I've always admired that, and you know, try to do that, but it's not easy.
Well, you've given us a richness of imagery, though, that is very different than Beckett.
The part of that has to do with the fact that I also write poetry.
And so I'd love for you to talk about your poetry.
Well, my basic premise in poetry, in writing poetry, is that I look for the concrete image. I look for the solid image in front of me that's unusual, and that will in some way or other represent something bigger, larger, more universal than the image itself. But the image has to be there. The image has to be like an anchor in the poem to make it work for me. My pet peeve is abstract writing when it comes to poetry, and I really dislike that. I dislike the use of abstract words in poetry. So, and it shows when I select poetry for my for the publishing house as well. But
yeah.
That's the thing that I work towards in my poetry. And you know, of course, the images shouldn't be cliched. They have to have some sort of startle effect for the reader, and you know, to make the reader go beyond just the page, just the image itself, so that it becomes, like I said, more universal.
Yeah.
And thus, hopefully, meaningful. Hopefully, I mean, doesn't always happen, but you know, and the definition of meaningful changes all the time anyway. So, but especially in the world we're in today, with you know, a lack of hierarchy and a lack of mentors, a lack of canonical truth, as it were. Anyway,
one of the themes that you've explored over and over again, you've mentioned, is self-knowledge and the metrics we use to examine ourselves.
Right.
So tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, it's I one of the things that I really like doing, and I find difficult to do, is what I call a metafiction. And metafiction is that self-examination. Self-examination of the writing, in fact, not just of the self, but you're actually writing about your writing. So at that point, you do some type of self-consciousness, self-awareness, self-examination. The interesting thing about that is that it's a never-ending cycle. It becomes a problem at some point. I know writing where there's an examination of the examination of the writing. And then there's an examination of the examination of the examination, and so on. And so you get into this cycle that I described it at one point as this is when you no longer have belief in an external savior of some kind, or salvation, and so you're left, and then we get back to the existential.
Yes.
And so you're like, to me, there is a slight problem with that, because it's you're always digging out the material from underneath yourself, and at some point, once you dig out that material from underneath yourself, you're just gonna fall. And there's no place for you to land once you do that kind of self-examination. It also comes down to you know, the theories on a lack of identity, of an essential identity, that you know, what is a human being, what makes a human being, once you eliminate, as I said, once you eliminate hierarchies, once you eliminate canonical thinking, once you eliminate our superiors, as it were. You know, once we no longer listen to government, to religion, to church, to all of these things that we've kind of brushed aside in terms of self-examination. Not necessarily everybody brushes them aside. That's not true. There's, you know, in fact, a lot of people reach out to those
yes.
when they discover that
yes.
there's a, that you know there's not much left in the world.
Right. This is what they hang on to. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the other going the other way, the self-examination can also lead to deep holes, depression, because you're always always questioning yourself, always questioning things.
Isn't that the feeling you get from for instance, Godot? There is that overwhelming sense of hopelessness.
There is, and yet at the same time, there is that the hope, the friendship that seems to be in at least there seems to be where the hope is. I mean, he describes our life as we're being born over the grave. There's a line in there about giving birth over the grave. So, in other words, you know, we all have a lifespan, and that's it. But what we make of that, and the relationships that we develop, and the friendships, and you know, the family dynamics that we create, I think, in that sense, although it's bleak, but at the same time, there's something to hold on to, someone else to hug, to share.
Yes.
Share that bleakness.
If we bring that back to The Photographer in Search of Death, which is the short story in this collection, that is the title story, and you've done that in this story, the relationships between the characters, you've given us that as a point to seize on, and we keep
right,
circling
yeah.
back to those relationships.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, that you know, the photographer tries to capture death while the photographer is trying to capture death, there are all these relationships going on around them, and that's the real meaning of the story, opposed to the actual trying to capture this image of death. What is the image of death? There's no way.
Well, it keeps shifting, and also, of course, all around him, the environment is crumbling. So I don't want to give any spoilers for our listeners out there, but what you've just described is so well represented in this story. The relationships that are the central focus, even though everything else around is crumbling or changing.
And also the characters themselves in
yes.
cases don't even realize their relationships are important.
Yeah.
Because we are so focused on whatever, you know, trying to buy a new TV or trying to decide what kind of shoes we're going to wear or that sort of thing. I think sometimes we forget that what the most important things are in our lives. So, yeah, in a way, that's one of the things I tried to get across in the photographer.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another story in there called The Savior.
Yes. Oh, I love it. I love it. It's so dark. You're reading it and you're feeling like, I don't want to read anymore, but you have to keep reading. It was one of those.
Well, but at the same time, you know, that is a relationship.
Yes.
And in fact, it's a relationship that a lot of people have, a kind of a dependency.
It's so real. It just makes you shudder.
Well, I'm glad it worked for you. A lot of readers will enjoy.
I think enjoy
in quotes.
It might give you nightmares, but. Michael, we're just going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsors. And when we come back, I'd like to talk about your publishing house, Guernica Editions. We're going to be right back with Michael Marola. We're speaking about Michael's latest book, which is a collection of short stories, The Photographer in Search of Death. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about Guernica Editions. So listeners, please stay with us for Storylines on the Bay 88.7 FM. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Storylines on the Bay 88.7 FM. I'm your host, Christine Cowley, and our guest today is Michael Marola, author and publisher with Guernica Editions. Michael, before the break, I had mentioned that we would be coming back to talk about your imprint, Guernica Editions. And to just start off, I'd like to talk about the name of the press and how that name was chosen. Just tell us a little bit about the actual history of Guernica.
Okay. Well, it started with the original owner and founder, Antonio D'Alfonso, in 1978. He was at the time he was looking he was looking for someone or some publishing house to publish his material and the material of his friends. And then he went on a trip to Europe, and he traveled around, and he visited the village that's depicted.
Yes.
In Picasso's painting.
Of the same name? Yeah.
In Spain. And he had a flash, and that was, and he decided that he would start a press, and he would call that press Guernica, in honor of Picasso's painting, and hopefully to carry on a kind of a legacy, social, cultural, political, that the painting represents. It represents a horror image in terms of the fact that the village was bombed by Franco during the Spanish Civil War.
And so it has come to represent the atrocity of war and the senselessness of war, and it has been described as it was just a sort of a practice run leading up to World War II. So of course the senselessness of the loss of life and everything. It was obliterated.
Exactly. So that's where Antonio came back to, out of Montreal. And that's where the press started. And basically, originally, the press was there because he was upset about the fact that his material wasn't being published by other Canadian publishing houses.
And this is poetry.
That it was other poets in Montreal. So that's how the press actually started. He published some Montreal poets, both in English and French, and some in Italian, actually.
And Michael, you took it over in 2010 with your partner Connie McParland.
That's right. Yeah.
And then you wanted to move forward from the poetry, the legacy that Antonio D'Alfonso started the press with, and you moved into graphic novel, science fiction. You consider yourself a literary publishing house, and now you've even moved into memoir, for instance.
Right. Antonio, by the time he moved to Toronto, and that was 1993, Antonio was already publishing novels.
So he had expanded.
Non-fiction. He started a series called the Writers Series,
uh-huh.
which is a nonfiction series where you take a Canadian author and you create a critical anthology of the author, publishing material works. It's essays on the author's works.
Right.
We're up to number 50, I think, right now for that. So yeah, so you know, he was already into that. But what we did was we kind of rationalized the whole thing. I mean, the problem as much as you want to be culturally relevant and all that, it's still a business.
Yes.
And so you need to find some way to keep going in terms of having revenue come in and
yes.
all of that. So we, my partner and I decided that we rationalize a little bit and cut back a little bit on the poetry and increase the fiction and nonfiction. At the same time, we opened up a new imprint. We called it Miroland, a combination of my name and Connie's name.
Yes.
Marola and McParland. The Miroland imprint is where we publish, call it more commercial material, wider readership sort of thing. We have memoirs, as you mentioned. We published a graphic novel. We're about to publish volume 2 of the graphic novel. We published speculative fiction this year by Claude Lalumière, Banner of Dreams, it's called. We're doing an adult coloring book.
Great. They're getting a lot of good reviews.
The Crypto Philosopher's Coloring Vault.
I'm going to have one. It's going to have to be on my Christmas list.
And so, yeah, so we've moved into, we've expanded the press, but we still want to maintain the original mandate, which was to try to get marginalized voices out there
uh-huh.
to maintain a diversity of voices. Right now, you know, the word diversity has become very popular, but Guernica has been doing that for almost 40 years now. So that's where we are now, and things are going quite well.
And you're attracting mid-list authors, and also a number of your books have been shortlisted for awards.
Yeah, I mean, that's always a luck of the draw in some ways to get those nominations. But we've had some of our poets nominated for a Trillium Awards. We had someone nominated for the Toronto Arts Award. The League of Canadian Poets has nominated three of our poets, I think, and one was nominated for the Canada for the Governor General's Award.
Part of your mandate is to be choosy about the titles you publish, but of course, as you say, it's also a business.
Make these decisions, but yeah, the two of us make all the decisions really about which books are going to be published. We have a set number of fiction books that we're going to publish,
right?
A number of poetry books every year. We try to publish one or two poetry books in a series called the First Poets series.
Tell us about that.
Well, the First Poets is a series where we published the first collection, first full collection. They could have published chapbooks previously, but the first full collection of a poet under the age of 35. We want to get fresh voices in. And this is
part of your diversity.
Yeah, that as well. And you know, but the diversity side of things, you know, I think we're pretty well covered. Last year we published an Iranian Canadian poet. We published George Eliot Clark. We published a black gay poet. Italian poet. We published a Canadian Pakistani short story writer. So you know, we that side of it. I think we're doing pretty well.
Yes.
We want to try to introduce fresh voices always. At the same time, you know. Having people like George Eliot Clark on the list is helps quite a bit.
Sure.
In terms of getting publicity.
And name recognition and all of that.
Exactly. Yeah. And we published Austin Clark's two poetry collections, and that was quite an honor. Unfortunately, he passed away. But that was for Austin to come to us. We felt really, really good about that, the material he wrote was very much in tune with Guernica's mandate, the political / social, commentary on what's happening out there. We feel we're in a good place, and you know, you always want to do more. Like to get a little more recognition. It's tough. The award system, the awards are good, but at the same time, it's a bit of a closed world.
Yes.
There's no point complaining about it.
Yeah.
You just get out there
and work within it as best you can.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think our listeners will be happy to hear that we're going to be featuring a number of Guernica's authors starting in January. And
fantastic.
Yeah, so we're really looking forward to speaking to more Guernica authors and featuring those voices that you've just mentioned. So that's going to be a real pleasure for us. Michael, we've run out of time. I want to thank you so much for joining us this morning on Storylines.
All right. Well, thank you for having me. I look forward to speaking to you again at some point.
And I just want to mention again that The Photographer in Search of Death, your latest collection of short stories, is available now. It's from Exile Editions. Listeners, you can go to www.exileeditions.com to order your copy. And if you're thinking of Christmas presents, this might be a nice check mark on your list. Again, Michael, thank you so much for joining us. And we will look very forward to featuring your authors on Storylines in the future. Thanks, listeners, for tuning in this morning to Storylines on the Bay 88.7 FM. I'm your host, Christine Cowley. We're here in two new time slots, Saturday mornings at 8:05 a.m. and Wednesday nights at 11 p.m. We will keep on talking to authors and book folks about books and the writing life. Please join us again.